Solve, secure, protect. Look to Patel for the independent thinking and cross-disciplinary focus it takes to advance security and safety in a changing world. They provide their clients with integrated solutions that secure our nation and help solve challenges within infrastructure, environment, emerging threats, and deployable mission-ready technology. Their teams leverage their deep expertise to develop science and technology for a healthier, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit Patel.org to learn how Patel makes the impossible possible. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. Thanks for listening. On this episode, we return to AOC 2022, which took place a few weeks ago. During the show, I had the opportunity to sit down with author, futurist, and former NSA officer, Dr. Eric Hazeltine. I was also joined by special co-host, retired U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Guy Walsh, now serving as Executive Director of the National Security Collaboration Center at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Dr. Hazeltine is an accomplished neuroscientist whose career brought him right into the heart of our EMSO and cyber professions. He was a former CTO for National Intelligence at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the Director of Research at the NSA, an Executive Vice President at Walt Disney Imagineering, and a Director of Engineering at Hughes Aircraft Company. Eric has authored or co-authored more than 40 patents in optics, special effects, electronic media, and is widely published in leading magazines and academic journals. So with that, I want to bring you to my discussion with Dr. Eric Hazeltine and special co-host Guy Walsh. Let's listen in. All right, so just to get us started here, and then I really will stop talking, I do promise. But, you know, one of the thrusts of your discussion at AOC 2022 and through your books has been really about, innovation, but really innovation through relationships. And I would like to get just kind of a take, Dr. Hazeltine, on to provide us some context on for the discussion today about the role that relationships play in advancing innovation and new ideas in a bureaucracy.
Yeah, well, when I started off as a system engineer in 1979, we thought that if you wanted to innovate, it was 95% technology and 5% all the other stuff, marketing, contracts, all that other stuff. Now, 40-some years later, I know that it was in the reverse. That if you want to innovate, it's 5% technology and 95% all that other stuff, which I would categorize as relationship building. When you're an innovator, your real job is changing human behavior. You're doing something new, and humans have to use it. Humans have to design it, build it, sell it, buy it, operate it, maintain it, and update it. And if that entire chain doesn't buy in from the start, you will not succeed. So the one piece of advice I'd give to any innovator is shift the focus and the frame of reference from innovating in technology to building relationships to make the technology get there.
So, Doctor, first, your briefing today was absolutely fascinating. And for the listeners who weren't able to attend this year's AOC International Symposium, I just want to say, number one is congratulations, Ken, because again, with the audience that you have, with the expanded type piece there, but also bringing in a lot of the young crows. And so the audience did look different, had a different feel this time. And I will simply tell you that Dr. Eric Hazeltine's presentation was not only fascinating, but it's different than probably most of those you've heard on this podcast, right? Because again, his career path is much, much different, being a neuroscientist, a futurist, coming out of Disney Imagineering. And again, from a introductory, for those who haven't met and had the chance to talk with Eric, I will simply say that the best introduction was probably done on the book, his previous book, which was A Spy in Moscow Station, and where Michael Hayden talks about hiring Eric out of Disney Imagination to lead research group out of the National Security Agency. So bringing that. And Michael Hayden explained it, saying this was the most bold and audacious move I've ever made at that time, is bringing someone from industry to change and to shake things up, really. And we saw that today. And so we were making a little bit of a joke earlier that this is probably the first time at an AOC conference we had discussion about pom-pom crabs and sea urchins and porcupines. But really that idea of convergence of different themes and different flavors, you really did hit the nail on the head with that. So just a little bit, again, thoughts about what we've just talked about in terms of bringing in convergence of different ideas. You spent a lot of time today talking about that convergence between EW and cyber and really pulling the strings there. So just share with our audience a little bit about that.
Well, I think I want to start at 100,000 feet. And that is, EW is primarily in most people's minds about technology. But the illusion is that technology is different from biology. It is not. It is designed and built and operated by biological entities for biological purposes, political purposes. Clausewitz said, war is politics with violence. And EW is basically about advancing one group's needs over another. And so if you look at it that way, you look at EW in a completely different perspective, as a natural outgrowth of biology, not something apart and separate from it. And that's hugely important in getting fresh ideas. And what I said in my talk was that you need to look at the wisdom of nature over billions of years, and all the answers are there. So in my talk, I went into all the different ways that prey animals mess with their predators' heads and vice versa, and said there's got to be some fresh ideas in there for the future for EW. And I gave some examples of that. I also talked about, once you have an innovation, how do you get it across the valley of death into mission onto the battlefield? And that's where we come back to things like fusion that you just mentioned. What I said in the talk is that EW and cyber are on a collision course to become something new, which we don't yet have a name for. Someone will come up with it sometime, but the way I look at it is, really, if you're honest with yourself, an EW system is a computer with a RF front end and an antenna. And so the distinction between cyber and EW is not a distinction worth it anymore, in my opinion. For example, you radiate signals that get looked at as either baseband or carrier by the receiver. They get put in a buffer somewhere that's a digital, which is connected to a network somewhere. So if you're radiating signals, what's to say that those couldn't be cyber-type signals? You're in a buffer, maybe you could do a buffer overflow. And so I think that that's kind of the new frontier. And the biggest obstacle, because it's something new and unfamiliar to people, is going to be changing people's behavior. You're going to say, oh, that's a cyber problem. That's in that silo. No, that's an EW problem. That's in that silo. And the reality is, it's in the white spaces of the national security enterprise. It's a new thing that needs to be given life on its own as a separate thing.
So let me pull on that string a little bit. And you just said it. You said all the answers are there. But you earlier had also said, we're just not asking the right questions. And that was, I think, key. So you spend a lot of time, just as you did in that description, of saying, here are some of the questions we really need to be answering. You know, so I'll throw that out in a broad. What are the key scientific questions we should be answering right now?
I think, again, I'll start at 100,000 feet. What is the problem we're trying to solve? Zhao Enlai, the number two guy under Mao Zedong, said, the first step to solving a problem is to name it. What is the core underlying problem that EW tries to solve? It's how to be a windshield instead of a bug. How to not be a prey, and how to be an effective predator. And how to do it in a very fast-changing world where some of our adversaries are changing much faster than we are, with resources we can't even dream of. You take the Chinese, for example. They spend hundreds of billions of dollars on cell phones and computer chips and things like that, and then they design them from the start to have dual use. We can't compete with that. And they work at the speed of commercial, not the speed of the FAR. And so we have to understand the big problem that we're trying to solve. And like I say, biology has all the answers because prey animals live right next to their predators. If you watch that movie, My Octopus Teacher, it's fascinating because you have this octopus, which is very smart, living literally right next to a shark. There's no containment. You know, so if you look at the cyber analogy, you have to assume that the enemy is in your system and operate with the assumption that you can still operate even though you've been penetrated. And that's what the octopus does. And if you watch that movie, you'll see 10 different strategies it uses to putting, you know, seashells on top of it so it looks like the sea bottom, to jumping on the shark's back and going for a ride, to giving up a tentacle to the shark and, you know, healing with the rest of his body. There's like 10 different strategies. And I think the answers are all there if we only know where to look.
So let's, one of the things we talked about in your presentation is that transition from offense and defense. You know, which is more important? Where can you find success? And so, and in the bio examples you just got, you talked about several that are, these are defensive, but here's also some of the, I'm going to use the word attack, given my background, but the offensive type of things and being able to blend and transition between that. So talk to us the difference in terms of our approach of offensive and defensive, whether it be on the cyber, EW, wherever.
Great question. I'll tell you something as a neuroscientist. Our brains are taxonomic. We put things in boxes, like offense and defense. But actually, nature isn't that way. Nature doesn't see a distinction between offense and defense. And I'll give you an example. You have this beetle larvae that is preyed upon by amphibians, frogs and toads. And what it has evolved is a way of when the frog eats it, it grabs onto the frog's mouth and it starts eating the frog. So it puts out signals that say, come here, frog, eat me. And then the frog grabs it. It thinks it's a prey, and it turns out it's the prey. And that's nature. There really is this distinction between offense and defense, and it's hugely important that people get their head around that because, again, in bureaucracies, those tend to be different people with different cultures, with different organizations, with different budgets, when in reality it's all one thing. That you can go from being a prey to a predator in a heartbeat. When you come to cyber, I've always said, well, look, we know that really clever nation-state adversaries are going to get inside of us. It's just a fact. No one wants to admit it, but it's true. So we need to find them. We need to control it. But let's assume that we can use it. Let's play judo. Maybe we can shape their perception by steering them in certain areas, and then we get inside them. So I think having the mindset that every prey is a predator and every predator is a prey is really important.
I want to jump in here. I want to pull the thread on success because I'm very curious from an advocacy perspective, which is what I spent my career doing, less technology. People always ask, what is advocacy? And there's a lot of stock answers for that, but it's basically operating in a way that puts your organization or who you're working for in a better spot down the road. Whether your mission is electronic warfare or cyber, making you better off. And the question of success comes up. You know, what is success? And I sometimes feel like we too narrowly define what success is, and that can lead to more failure. And what I try to talk about is understanding the problem and accepting the fact that you might succeed, but it might look completely different than what you originally anticipated, and allowing for that, say, hey, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and if we succeed, maybe we succeed in a different way, and maybe we've happened upon solving another problem that we weren't aware of at first, and keeping those lines of communication open that involves relationships. So I wanted to, when you talk about Valley of Death, moving technology forward, integration of cyber and EW, do we too narrowly define success too quickly in our efforts, and can that lead us astray, or how do you deal with the question of what is success in this space?
Well, that's a tough one when it comes to EW because the field is esoteric. The people who make the budget decisions have a very hard time. In my experience, some of the very brightest and best government employees or congressional staffers. They're very smart people. That's why they have their jobs. But even they sometimes have trouble getting their head around, well, what are you talking about? And it's very difficult to grasp. And I've noticed this, and it's in my book, The Spy in Moscow Station. One reason we didn't find this Russian implant for many, many years is it was like magic. It was like voodoo. Well, that's not possible. And a lot of what EW does is like that. It's like really esoteric, complex, hard to understand. And I'll just get back to something Harry Truman said, a very effective Washington insider. He said, in Washington, you have to be clearer than the truth. And that means that the people who make decisions, politicians and policymakers, have an agenda. They have something they're trying to do. And I would say, how to frame what you're doing as the answer to their problem. My boss, John Negroponte, who was the ultimate deputy secretary of state under Condi Rice, but at the time he was the ODNI, I reported to him. I said, what is diplomacy? You know, all your guys here, you brought in the State Department. He said, Eric, diplomacy is the art of letting other people have your way. And I said, well, how do you do that? And he said, you've got to make it look like their idea. And the way you look at their ideas, you don't present them, you don't sell them anything. You come in and you sit down and you ask them and you say, what keeps you up at night? What's your biggest problem? And whatever that is, you come up with something that aims in that direction. You basically push into pull. And so you're not going to change people's mind. They already have something they need to accomplish. I think the advocacy piece really is about understanding where their head is and putting what you have in there. I look at people as having a soda straw. They look at the world through a soda straw. And that's their silo. But a policymaker or a politician is no different. They have things they want to accomplish. You can't get them to shift their soda straw to look at what you want them to. They're not going to do it. You have to take what you have and put it in their soda straw.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank Battelle for their continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. It's always great to hear from them, and I am pleased to be here with Rusty Colemorgan, Navy veteran and division manager at Battelle. Rusty, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've had an interesting career with extensive stints in the Navy and industry. What brought you to Battelle, and how does your experience align with Battelle's mission?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And I did have a very rewarding career as a Navy pilot. And as I transitioned through a number of companies in industry, I continued to have great experiences because I got the chance to work alongside eye-watering technical talent. What I'm most excited about at Battelle is how our campus is literally surrounded by an impressive depth of relevant applied researchers. That uniquely embedded in-house research capability serves as a foundation as we focus on solutions to the world's hardest problems. We strive to create a better world through science, and the RavenStar technology is the latest example of a hard problem with wide society benefits.
In the past, we've heard here on From the Crow's Nest from your colleagues, Doug Thornton and Molly Engel. They provided some intriguing insights about the RavenStar antenna. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenges of this trade space and what you're trying to address with this game-changing technology?
Well, the bottom line is that users have had to sub-optimize their capabilities and needs with traditional design approaches in the RF spectrum. Traditionally, electronic warfare and command and control users want a number of capabilities that create a challenging design space. Those needs are typically long ranges, maximum throughput, and low probability of intercept, low probability of detection. They want those ranges for more effective operational reach or standoff, and they want more throughput for the increased data that leads to actionable intelligence. And those tight control of the emissions, they want those for either maximizing energy on a particular bearing or limiting the ability to detect or interfere with their emissions. It's not an easy trade space, but the flexibility of the RavenStar architecture gives them more of what they want operationally.
So what does the RavenStar do that makes it optimized across these critical performance needs, and how does that stand out from traditional approaches?
Well, our frequency agility gives operators flexibility to work an ultra-wide portion of the spectrum through a single low-swap software-defined aperture. RavenStar co-designed extremely wide-band aperture arrays with co-located advanced electronics. And this allows a compact, frequency-flexible RF solution. Our approach minimizes conventional antenna feature trade-off and allows significant design flexibility for delivering the spectrum dominance that's needed.
We've been tracking this program here on the show. How mature is RavenStar today?
We put it at a TRL 6 after testing that we've done in December of 2023 and continuing into this year. We'll do field tests, accompany lab demonstrations, and development performance on formal efforts with different DoD customers, all that are pointed toward a continued maturation of the RavenStar design. They show the RavenStar's ability is to support all domain missions that require multiple communications.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for joining me here on the show. It's always great to hear from the Patel team. And now it's time to get back to our show.
So let's stay there with a spy on Moscow station, because, again, this was a book talking about what was happening in the late 70s, early 80s. And I'm going to look at the bureaucracies that you deal with in that, particularly between State Department, NSA, CIA, because obviously there wasn't a lot of everybody getting that thought. So where has that come, that bureaucratic challenge, both in terms of how have we gotten better and where has it gotten worse as we've moved from the 70s and what was happening at Moscow at the embassy to where we are today between those, and let's just start with those agencies that you address in A Spy in Moscow Station.
Bluntly, no better. When I went to, you know, many years after the book, I went to my counterpart at another three-letter agency who was a deputy director of the Agency for Science and Technology, and I said, Dr. X, who will be nameless, I said, look, I'm from Disney. I just got here. I want to cooperate. I think, you know, SIGINT, HUMINT, the natural thing together. He says, Eric, you don't understand. Al-Qaeda is our target. You are our enemy. You, NSA. You know, that was in the early 2000s. There have been some measures with joint purpleness and joint duty and Goldwater Nichols, and now we have ODNI, and there is some goodness there. But generally speaking, you're fighting human nature. Humans are tribal. That will never change. You may, like what they did with DNI to solve this problem, to get people to communicate and cooperate. I was there for 2 years. I saw it firsthand. We failed utterly. We did things that on paper looked right. And some of it actually did work when it came to IT plumbing. But generally speaking, the silos remain very healthy and pretty much fighting each other. In my book, The Spy in Moscow Station, I have a chart called the Who Hates Who chart. And I think that chart's pretty accurate. And thank God our adversaries have their own Who Hates Who chart.
So I'm going to take this to the positive side from that book. So one of the most poignant pieces in The Spy at Moscow Station was Charles Gandy, who was one of the lead, I'll say, thinkers of that time. But it's an event when suddenly under Project Gunman, that Mike Aronson, a young person working there at NSA, working in R9, that is not going to, you know, he doesn't have the degree, he's not promotable, those type of things, but he's absolutely brilliant. He thinks out of the box, and he makes the discovery on the IBM Select 3 typewriter that no one else could do in what it was about week 9 or so. But could you talk us through what Charles Gandy does? Because it's important for all our readers to understand. You talk about the human element. But what does Charles Gandy do after he gets the phone call, realizes that he's got a young kid that thinks he's this guy, but before he walks out the door, he does something very important that is life-changing.
Yeah. He has his wife, who's an artist, make a big award because he had set up a $10,000 reward for whoever found the exploit first, and Aronson did. But he realized that money was much less important than recognition and respect. And for Aronson in particular, who didn't even have a degree at the time, respect was the most important thing that he wanted. And so Gandy was a genius when it came to technology, but even more, he understood people really well. And he understood that if you want to get and keep the best people, you've got to give them the freedom to do what they want, and you've got to recognize and reward them the second they do something excellent.
So let me go back to one of the areas that we talked about that's important to a lot of the folks here today. It's all about recruiting and retaining talent. And part of what we, you know, it goes back to the thing, are we asking the right questions? And we talked about if all we're looking for is 5 years of experience in the EW or the cyber side, we're not broadening that look to bring in that divergence of talent from those other areas. Difficult to do. If you look at our HR system, it is built to do that, is to say, who's the smartest guy in EW? Who's been our biggest salesman? Who's been our biggest inventor? Who's been our biggest, you name that. But we're not looking into areas where people bring a completely different view of what's happening. So how do we make that change?
Well, I want to start with the point of getting inside the head of the people you're trying to deal with, which is new talent. What motivates them? You know, people talk about money, but in reality, most HR studies show that money is not the big motivator for most employees. It's achievement, fulfillment, and recognition, and accomplishment. And so I think that if you say, look, we've got some incredible challenges here, like, for example, in AI, we've got a really fascinating problem where we have our AI going up against someone else's AI. And that's the kind of thing that's going to capture the imagination of the kind of person you want. So you look at all of your problems as liabilities, but they're your biggest recruiting asset, because you can go to someone and say, look at this problem that we have. Our AI is going up against their AI. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is, this is going to sound horrible, but one reason NSA is able to recruit some of the best mathematicians in the world is it's hard for them to get jobs elsewhere. There's only so many tenure track. Now, with Hollywood using CG and quants and Wall Street, the demand for mathematicians has increased. But the fact is that they didn't have a lot of options. If you go to behavioral science schools, people getting PhDs in social psychology or industrial psychology or human factors, and you recruit them, because any EW system, usually the weakest link is the human and also the strongest link. So behavioral science, I think, does need to be an added dimension. But also biologists. If you go and you get zoologists and people who are experts in the kind of stuff I talked about today, you can pay them salaries that they couldn't get anywhere else, and they might be very interested. So I think some of the talent that you need is out there. It just doesn't look like the talent you're looking for. And I will say one thing. You know, I'm a neuroscientist, but I write Python code and I write C++. These people can learn to do the skills that you need. And I think you will find that their weaknesses are also their strengths. They don't think like engineers, and that's a good thing sometimes. So I would say go to the traditional disciplines, but find out what's a big problem and a challenge that will keep them challenged, and give them something they can't get anywhere else. Give them the recognition. Have your best people go out and recruit. Usually if you have an HR person go out and recruit for that kind of talent, it isn't going to work. You got to take your superstars and you got to get them out there. And a new superstar who's embryonic, when he sees a real superstar, is going to say, I want to go work with that person. You have to look at, we called those magnets at Disney. We got our very best Imagineers, and we were the one that we put them on the front lines to recruit, because those were the biggest magnet that brought people in.
So one of the panels that was done earlier during the AOC International Symposium here was about one of those big challenges that we have right now is JADC2, the Joint All Domain Command and Control. And as we sort of discussed in the panel it's really about, it's not as much about command and control as it is shortening that kill chain. What can we automate? How do we really bring both the cyber and the EW type pieces in there? And right now we're seeing that as a challenge in itself, even just getting the services between ABMS, Project Overmatch, Convergence, and bringing those together. Help us to look forward from a visionary perspective. How do we take those next steps to change the battlefield in the way we want to give us success on the battlefield?
Well, I want to go back to biology, because when you think about nature, a new organism just doesn't pop de novo from nothing. Like the particle-antiparticle pairs that pop out of the void to create dark energy. They always evolve from something that just preceded them, and it's usually a little twist in a gene that does it. And so you say, well, that's how nature actually does it. Like when it comes to the fusion of EW and cyber, it's not like you create a new animal all of a sudden that does that. What you do is you take something that already does that and you do a twist to it and make it do it. So the way I would approach that problem is to say, it's already happening. JADC2 is already happening. The fusion of cyber and EW is already happening. We still call it that. And if we look at all the nodes and edges in all the platforms that we have, And we took a step back and say, well, that's what they're doing now, but what could we make them do that's different? And do like nature does and patch and tweak and adjust and bend it till it breaks. And when you bend it and it's out there in mission and it's actually saving lives and helping accomplish the mission, people would say, oh, this is great. We need more of that. And then someone says, well, to have more of that, you need a new platform. And then a new requirement will come about. So I think it's the bend it till it breaks strategy. It's a lot more practical to do modifications to program from the record than trying to get some new big program for the record through. And I think that's actually what's probably going to end up happening.
I just want to jump in on, you have two books that you talked about during your presentation today. The other one is Riding the Monster, Five Ways to Innovate Inside a Bureaucracy. And you know, without giving too much of the book away, but it's really chock full with real good advice. And I think that what was refreshing was sometimes you oftentimes hear, well, your bureaucracy stands in the way. But you offer ways to work with it instead of against it in a gentle way that makes the bureaucracy think that it's actually doing what you want. You know, so and one of the things you talk about with innovation was... you know, sometimes innovation isn't just about the new technology, but it's about optimizing what you already have, and you just kind of touched on that. What can you share with us a little bit about what inspired you to get to write this book at this time, and a little bit about, you know, what our listeners can glean from, you know, how to engage the bureaucracy in a more healthy and productive way?
Well, I've been an innovation guru ever since I left the government in 2007, make a lot of money going to C-suites and offering wise opinion. And basically everything I tried failed. I made a lot of money, but all the things I tried didn't work. And plus, most of my career as an innovator and running research labs was mostly failure, to be bluntly honest. And that goes with the turf, but I think there was more failure than there need to be. So I looked back and said, what was the thread that wove all these failures together? And I realized it was simple. It's that the crossing the valley of death, getting innovations across, really was not a technology gap, not a process gap, not a funding gap for productization money, a relationship gap. That you didn't have all of the informal relationships of trust and respect that were needed to get something across the finish line and to look at it as a chain. You talk about the kill chain, the innovation chain. Someone has to have the idea. Someone has to build a prototype. Someone has to want that and then turn the product into a real product and shrink wrap it. Someone has to want to put money in the budget to buy it. Someone has to buy it. Someone has to operate it. Someone has to maintain it. And if you don't get every single one of those steps online before you start, you will fail. And that is relationships. And so in my book, I talk about the way that is really done, not the way it's supposed to be done, is you do it by surfing human nature, not fighting it, which is people are tribal. So create healthy tribes and spend all your energy doing informal networking. Do whatever you have to do. Join the softball team. Join the corporate volunteer organization. Go to churches. Go to retirement ceremonies at NSA. I never missed a retirement ceremony because that's where I did my networking and that's where I got stuff done. And so you have to be street smart and look at the world as it really is, not the way they tell you it is.
So let's jump to, you always describe this as two problems. One is building those relationships, but the other one you bring up is don't underestimate your adversaries. And so that's a big piece in terms, and you talked a little bit about, and a lot of your background, the strength on understanding Russia, is where they don't just see everything as something new. They look at some of what I'll say the traditional areas, such as EW, and they become really good and maintain that skill craft in the area of RF, in the area of physics, acoustics, all those things that you bring out. So underestimating the adversary is that other half of the problem.
Well, that's right. And I think underestimating is one thing, but also not understanding. When it comes to the Russians in particular, I was a Russian cyber analyst at one of the three letters, open source, completely unclassified work. And I was never failed to be surprised that they just didn't think the way we thought. And my dad taught me this. My dad was a rocket scientist at China Lake. And every time there was an Arab-Israeli war, he'd look at some of the captured Russian stuff And he told me once, he said, they do not think like us. And he gave me an example of a fire control computer on an artillery piece. They'd taken a German design and they'd come up with a set of elliptical gears that were not shaped like gears at all, and you didn't think it worked, but right before one gear would clash with another, it would clear it just a little bit, and it was a genius computer that was simple, it would work anywhere, and he said no Western mind ever would have come up with that. And they are different. And I think that the only way to appreciate that difference is to live in their world and to speak their language and immerse yourself in it. And then you start to look at the world the way they do. And I think I would say respecting is one thing, but becoming them is another.
Well, General, that is all the time we have for today's episode. I want to thank both of you for joining me. Again, the two books that we discussed during the episode by Dr. Eric Heseltine is The Spy in Moscow Station, A Counter-Spy's Hunt for a Deadly Cold War Threat, and Riding the Monster, Five Ways to Innovate Inside Bureaucracies. Dr. Heseltine and General Walsh, thank you for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks again. This was wonderful. I look forward to coming back next year. Thanks, Ken.
That will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Eric Heseltine and Guy Walsh, for joining me at AOC 2022. Also, don't forget to review, share, and subscribe to this podcast. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners, so please take some time to let us know how we're doing. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Battelle, the world's largest independent, not-for-profit, applied science and technology organization. Since 1929, their mission has been to translate scientific discovery and technology advances to benefit society. Through markets such as health, environment, infrastructure, industry, and national security, Battelle has been delivering cutting-edge solutions that impact the well-being of the world and help keep us safe at home. To learn more, go to battelle.org/connect. That's BATTELLE.org/connect.